Okay, Parshas Acharemos Kedoshim has so many different topics and mitzvos to talk about. Parshas Kedoshim in particular is a really jam-packed Parsha. But what I want to focus on today is something that is an offshoot of one of the mitzvos in the Parsha of Kedoshim. The Torah tells us, as chukosai tishmoru behemtecha lo sarbia kilayim. First of all, when we talk about a chukah, it means generally it's a mitzvah that we are expected to observe without really understanding what the reason for that instruction was. Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu ask us to do this? We don't exactly know. But that's a chukah. We do it anyway. Like Parah Aduma is the prime example. So here, once again, the Torah introduces this mitzvah as Eschukosai Tishmoru. Here is a heading of mitzvahs that are going to be in the category of chukim, which means you don't know exactly what the reason for them is. And what are they? Lo sarbiya kelayim, you're not allowed to have two animals working the field together, different animals. Sadcha lo sizra kelayim, I'm not allowed to plant in my field different kinds of plants together. Ubeged kilayim shatnez lo yala alecha. So I think most of the people in the room are probably not doing work in the field with animals. Most of us are probably also not planting vegetables or fruits. So kilayim, kilayim zroim, as it's referred to, is not really relevant. But what is relevant to us is the halacha of shatnez, that we're not allowed to wear clothing that have semer upishtim yachta. We're not allowed to have wool and linen woven together into one garment. That is referred to as kilayim or as shatnez, and that is something that the Torah says is a chukah. The truth is, this comes up once again in Parashas Kisetze. It's not limited to Kedoshim. The Torah repeats it again, where we are told, the sizra karmacha kilayim, pentikdal shamalei hazera shutizra tuas hakerem. Then the Torah says, those sachra shar b'chamar yachtav, you cannot have two different kinds of animals working the field together. And finally, those silba shatnez semer upishtim yachtav. So we have the same mitzvah, both in Parshas Kedoshim, once again reiterated in Parshas Kisetze. And what I find fascinating is that the Rishonim discuss, what is the tam ha-mitzvah? What is the reason for this mitzvah? Now that's very interesting, because the Torah itself writes, as we just mentioned, es chukosai tishmoru. The way we are introduced to this mitzvah is that there is no reason. This is a chukah. It's a chok. So why the Rishonim even bother by the question? What is the question? It shouldn't be a question at all. It should be an irrelevant point. The Torah said there is no reason. And yet, Rashi says on Chumash, you're right, it's a chukah. It doesn't really have to make sense to us. This is the gzeiras hamelach. This is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from us. What's fascinating to me is that the Ramban and the Ramban is in his commentary on Chumash, the Rambam is in the Mor Nevuchim, offer all kinds of suggestions to explain why is it that the Torah decided that kilayim is something that is very important for us to observe. Who cares? Why does the Torah mind if I wear this kind of garment or that kind of garment? So the Ramban explains the reason why is because ki bara Hashem minim ba'olam b'chol balei anafashos b'tzmachim u'b'balei nefesh v'nasa b'hem koach hatolda sh'iskaimu haminim b'hem la'ad. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world and he wanted to have everything in a certain way. So he wanted apples to grow like this and oranges to grow like that, and he wanted this animal to grow up and have children and have offspring that are going to be similar to it. And he didn't want that one animal should mate with another and then things are going to get all messed up. And he didn't want that this kind of fruit should be mixed up with the other one and then you're not going to have the pure original fruit as it was supposed to be put into the world. And therefore, says the Ramban, ha-markiv shnei minim, if you're going to have two animals working together, or you're going to have different kinds of fruits that are going to be planted together, or you have something like a beged of tzemer upishtim put together, which are really two separate items, says the Ramban, makhish b'maisa bereshis. It's as if you are saying, you know, God didn't do it right. I have a better idea. God created apples and oranges. I think it should be a combination of apples and oranges. God created this kind of animal, that kind of animal. I think the world would be a better place if we had one mixture of the two animals and we created a breed of both of them together. That, says the Ramban, is ki ilu makhish b'maisa bereshis. It's as if you're saying, you know, God is not good enough, and I'm going to come and improve his world. I'm going to make it different than the way he made it. Says the Ramban, that is a terrible thing. Ki ilu yachshov shohi hishlim HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba'olam kol hatzorach. It's like God made a deficient kind of world, and he needed me to come along to make it better. Interesting. Interesting. That's the way the Ramban explains this. Says the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim, his own idea. I'll tell you very practically. Mipnei shahaya bizman hahu beged yadua lekomrei balei akshafim. Says the Ramban, it has nothing to do with perfecting HaKadosh Baruch Hu's world. After all, says the Rambam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he doesn't say this, but it's obvious, he says. I just said he doesn't say. But I would think that it's obvious. The Torah says, milu es haaretz v'kibshuha. The job of man was to come into the world and to conquer the world. What does it mean to conquer the world? Who were they conquering? There was nobody here. What HaKadosh Baruch Hu was charging us with was, take all the world problems and try to fix them and try to figure out how to make the world a better place. That's your job. Milu es ha'aretz v'chivshua means try to overcome the obstacles. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world and it's an imperfect world, and our job is to make it just a little bit better, a little bit more positive than it was the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu created it. And therefore, says the Rambam, that has nothing to do with why we're not allowed to have tzemer u'pishtim, nothing to do with why we're not allowed to have two animals together. This is an entirely different reason. Says the Rambam, what is the reason? Because in the days of the Chumash, Bismanahu, there was a beged yadua lekomrei balik shafim. All of those who were involved in Avodah Zarah, all of those who were involved in necromancy, all of those people, bahem hayosim komaseim. They used to use these articles of clothing that had wool and linen mixed together. And says the Rambam, Levishahaya inyan gadol v'ratzilahem ha'od sheyuflu bo pu'losim hayaduas la'avodah zarah. Since they used to use clothing for their service of Avodah Zarah and for all of their black magic, they used to use clothing that were made of tzemer u'pishtim, that were made of wool and linen together. Therefore, says the Rambam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to make sure that we stay far away from that. So one of the instructions that he gave us to stay far away from those kinds of people is, don't ever wear such an article of clothing, even if you're not going to do magic, even if you're not going to serve Avodah Zarah, you're going to get too close to that style of life. And there says the Rambam, that is what this is all about. Fascinating, fascinating to see that the Rishonim here give their own kinds of reasons to explain why the Torah gave us this instruction of making sure that we don't wear shatness. There are two exceptions to the rule of where shatness would be permissible. What are those? The Gemara writes very clearly. Two places where shatness would be overlooked. The problem of shatness would be overlooked. One of those is by the mitzvah of wearing tzitzis, where the Torah says that we have a mitzvah to wear tzitzis, and even if the tzitzis are going to be made from wool and linen, which often they were, we would assume that the asay, the mitzvahs, the positive mitzvah of wearing tzitzis overrides the negative aveira of shatness. So that's the general principle of asay docha los asay. A big discussion in the beginning of Maseches Yevamos, where do we say it, where do we not say it, which cases does it apply to, where not. But in general, the Gemara says clearly that if one has a pair of tzitzis and it has shatnez in it, that would be something that we would overlook the issur of shatnez, and we would say the mitzvah of tzitzis overrides the shatnez. And the second place we find it is by Big Day Kuhuna. The Torah says that when one wears Big Day Kuhuna, we know that there were parts of the Big Day Kuhuna that specifically were designed with shatnez in them. The Torah prescribes that the way to make them is by taking wool and linen and weaving them together and creating this article of clothing. And therefore, in those two scenarios, both by Big Day Kuhuna as well as by the mitzvah of tzitzis, we say we overlook the isser, the aveira of shatnez, and we say the mitzvah of Big Day Kuhuna and the mitzvah of tzitzis override. Why would that be the case? Why would I say that those are not subject to the din of shatnez? So one reason is because the Gemara tells us mitzvahs lav lehenos nitnu. When I'm wearing the tzitzis or when I'm wearing the Big Day Kuhuna, I'm not wearing it because I want to get pleasure out of the tzitzis. I'm wearing it because God told me to do it. So the mitzvah was not given for hana. And the only prohibition of wearing shatnez, of wearing kilayim, is when I'm deriving benefit from the item, from the article of clothing that I'm wearing. If it's keeping me warmer, if it's a blanket that keeps me warmer, if it's a sheet that's covering over my bed, and that is going to help me somehow live in this bed, that would be something that would be prohibited. But let's say it's something that doesn't give me pleasure at all. Then there would be no prohibition of shatnez. And therefore, when I'm wearing a pair of tzitzis, or if I'm wearing the Big Day Kuhuna, since the point of wearing them is not at all to give me pleasure, but rather to do the mitzvah as I'm supposed to do it, therefore this would not be something that would apply. And secondly, the reason why we assume this is fine is because it would be under the category of asei docha los asei. As we mentioned, both Big Day Kuhuna and tzitzis, the Torah itself says you should go ahead and do the mitzvah in this fashion. And therefore we assume that that would override the problem, the potential prohibition of shatnez that would have otherwise been a major problem. What I want to focus on for the rest of this year is something that is not directly related to shatnez, but it's something that is an extension of shatnez, but very, very important halacha that we learn from this. And by way of introduction, what I'd like to talk about is when the halacha has concerns for human sensitivities. And that's what we're going to get to here, as it's an outgrowth from the whole sugya by shatnez itself. We're going to get to the Gemara soon after this introduction, but basically the Gemara that we're going to focus on is when the Gemara talks about the following scenario. Hayamahalech Bashuk. Says the Gemara, somebody's walking out in public. Bashuk means I'm in front of everyone. Doesn't mean specifically in the marketplace, but it means I'm out in the public sphere. And I realize that I'm wearing kilayim. I realize that I'm wearing an article of clothing that I'm not allowed to wear. So I'm not an expert in clothing. I don't know what's this, what's that. I don't know anything. But now I happen to notice the tag on the bottom of my new coat or my new dress or my new shirt or whatever it might be. And I realize that it says on it explicitly that it's wool and linen. My problem is I'm in the middle of the street. So what am I supposed to do? Of course, in a perfect world, if I was in my own home and I saw this before I got dressed, of course I wouldn't put it on. But now I'm already wearing it. And remember, this is in the times of the Gemara where they didn't have a coat with a scarf, with a sweater, with a shirt, with an undershirt and something else. They used to have one article of clothing. It was a robe. So it turns out I bought a new robe in the store, and now I see the tag on the bottom of the robe has a notice of what items are included in it. So would I assume that I have to be prepared to humiliate myself in the middle of the public square? I'm in front of other people. Do I have to disrobe? Do I have to get undressed in front of everyone because I don't want to violate the Isser D'Oraisa of Shatnez? Or would you say that is too much of an unreasonable expectation? And maybe the Torah would say, my human sensitivity becomes more important than the mitzvah itself. If I'm going to be so embarrassed and so humiliated by getting undressed in the middle of the street, then I would say, you know what, maybe it makes more sense for you to go home, take care of whatever you have to do, and then you take off whatever clothing that you're not supposed to be wearing. That's the question that the Gemara gets to. So before we get to that, I want to give a general introduction to this whole idea of Kavod HaBrios. Sometimes we talk about Kavod HaBrios, and what we don't realize is that this is a real consideration in halacha itself, in the process. It's not just a nice fluffy idea, it's something that really makes a relevant point when we talk about the halachic process itself. Moshe Rabbeinu, in the very end of his life, as we know, Moshe Rabbeinu feels that he has an obligation to admonish the Jewish people, to give them Musar for all the things that went wrong during his leadership of the Jewish people. In the last 40 years of his life, from the year 80 till age 120, Moshe Rabbeinu died at 120. He became the leader of the Jewish people at 80 years old, which from there we learn, you never know, right? You can have a whole new career at 80 years old. Life can start again. Moshe Rabbeinu never would have dreamt that this would be his life, and look what happened. Look what he accomplished. So it's never too late to accomplish great things. Moshe Rabbeinu, at the very end of his life, says that he is going to first give Musar to the Jewish people before he passes away. And that's what Sefer Dvarim is all about. Moshe Rabbeinu opens up and he says, Eila Dvarim Ashadibra Moshe. What did he choose to talk about? He spoke about this, he spoke about that, all the different mistakes, all the problems along the way. And he says, V'lavan v'chatzeiros v'dizahav. Ask Rashi, what does it mean? Moshe Rabbeinu makes mention of lavan v'chatzeiros v'dizahav. These are locations along the way where they travel. If he's trying to talk about a terrible mistake that they did there, why doesn't he mention what they are? Says Rashi, Manakan kala makom asher hisan bahen lefnei amakom. Moshe Rabbeinu here makes mention, he enumerates all the different places where HaKadosh Baruch Hu was angry at the Jewish people, v'hizkiram beremez, but he doesn't want to talk about them outright. He doesn't want to say, you did the Egel, or you fell in with the Meraglim. He doesn't want to talk about it. So what does he say? Mipnei kvodan shal Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu is nervous not to humiliate the Jewish people. So what does he do? All he does is, he says it beremiza. You know, you remember we were once traveling over here somewhere and something happened. He doesn't want to say it, so he just mentions it in passing and leaves it at that. That's the story of Moshe Rabbeinu. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz has a piece that became very, very famous in his Sefer Sichas Musar, and he writes the following. Let's learn it together. Moshe Rabbeinu, here he is, Yamim Sfurim Lifnei Moso. Here's Moshe Rabbeinu just a few days before he passed away. Bebo lohochiach es Am Yisrael ala chatoim hayiduim v'hamufursamim lakol. Moshe Rabbeinu is now giving tochacha, giving Musar, about issues that everybody knows about. There was nobody who was not aware of what happened with the Egel. Many Jews died at the time. There was a Magefa. Everybody knew what happened with the Meraglim. So why is Moshe Rabbeinu pretending like, you know, if you get my message, then you get it. And if you don't, yeah, I don't want to make anyone feel bad. You know, I don't want to call anybody out. What do you mean? Moshe Rabbeinu, like, we got it. We know what you're talking about. So he's talking about major mistakes, very well-known mistakes. Ubeinayim, and among those mistakes are Chet HaMeraglim and Chet HaEgel. And even though Moshe Rabbeinu is talking about very well-known problems and obstacles that he was confronted with in the Midbar, Nizar shalola faritis achatam beferish kedei shalola vaisha. He's afraid of humiliating the Jewish people. He doesn't want to embarrass them. And therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu decides, I'll just say it beremez, I'm not going to say it outright. Af shahaya bazem mishum mitzvahs tochacha. Moshe Rabbeinu has a mitzvah to give tochacha. That's his job. He's the leader of the Jewish people. He's supposed to tell them when they're making a mistake and how to correct their mistake. Ha'ein zem alamdenu, says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, does this not teach us? Magidola mailas kavod habrios v'chiyuv hazihiris ba. Does this not teach us how careful we need to be when we talk about this idea of kavod habrios? Moshe Rabbeinu is so worried about kavod habrios, even when he's talking about something that everybody knows what he's referring to. And still, he's so careful in the way he formulates it. Ve'en advar mamurim dafka b'kvodo shel haklal kulo. Maybe you'll say, says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, look, kavod habrios maybe is an important idea when you don't want to humiliate the entire Jewish people. You don't want to say lashon hara about an entire tzibur. You know, I'm always bothered when people make generalizations about communities. You say, oh, you know, the five towns is this. You might be right about some people. You know, you say, oh, Lakewood is that. You understand when you do such a thing, you're making such an overgeneralization, and you're painting people in a certain picture, in a certain image, in a certain light, which first of all cannot be accurate. It's so shallow to paint people like that. But even if it would be accurate, look at Moshe Rabbeinu. Even if it's something everybody knows, how do you dare write off an entire community and just say something like that, a broad stroke statement, where you're throwing everyone under one category, under the bus, and talking about them in a certain way? Yeah, if you're wondering why I'm saying this, yes, it's because there was a big news item this week. I don't know if you saw, you heard. Yeah, it's correct. Someone called him out very appropriately for writing something really silly. And who are you to call out a whole community and write something negative? Thank you. Someone follows the news, not everybody, but somebody here. So here, what we learned from Moshe Rabbeinu is to be careful. And says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, maybe you only have to be careful when you're dealing with a whole tzibur. Got to be careful with the feelings of everyone. When I'm dealing with a regular person, all right, you know, say something, yeah, what's the big deal? Says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, I'm going to show you that even the way he refers to it as the pachos shebebrios, the lowest segment of humanity, I need to be careful and vigilant about them as well. How do we know? Reb Chaim Shmulevitz proves it from the following story. Bilam HaRasha is one of the most infamous characters in all of Chumash. And what happens? Bilam was hired. Bilam was a Navi. You know that we say, Lo kam b'Yisrael kemoshe od. There was never a Navi in the Jewish community on the level of Moshe Rabbeinu. Yet the Medrash says, Avo b'uma sa'olam kam. You're right, there was never a Jew on the level of Moshe Rabbeinu, but there was a non-Jew on the level of Moshe Rabbeinu. You know who that was? Bilam. Bilam was a great person. He was in some way on the same level of prophecy of Nevuah as Moshe Rabbeinu. Amazing. And everybody knew that. And as a result of that, that is why Balak hires Bilam specifically, because he knows that he has superpower like Moshe Rabbeinu. So he goes to Bilam and he tries to get him to curse the Jewish people. As we know, as Bilam is traveling to go curse the Jewish people, what happens? He has this issue with his donkey, and he starts talking to the donkey, having a conversation, and in the end, he stops, he realizes, obviously this is the wrong thing to do. What happened to that donkey in the end? Where did the donkey go? Ever thought about it? What happened to the donkey? So Rashi tells us from the Medrash that in the end, HaKadosh Baruch Hu killed the donkey. Why did he kill the donkey? He should kill Bilam. What did the donkey do wrong? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, it's not right. It's not fair. From here on in, anyone who sees that donkey is going to point to the donkey and say, ah, when you start up with the Jewish people, even a donkey is better than you. It would have been so humiliating for Bilam. Nebuch, don't you feel bad for him? Everybody would have laughed at him. Every time they passed by the donkey, they would say, oh, you know the story of that donkey? We would start all going back in history and reminding ourselves of this crazy story with Bilam, this Meshuggah person who went to curse the Jewish people. And even the donkey spoke to him crazy. We don't want to humiliate Bilam. We feel bad for him, Nebuch. It's very sad. And therefore, as a result of that, says the Medrash, HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided we got to kill the donkey. Does that make sense to you? Think about it. If this happened in our generation, I would say, this is the greatest Kiddush Hashem. Look what happens when you mess with the Jewish people. look what happens when you try to destroy the Jewish people. You know, even a donkey is better than you. You know what I would have done with that donkey? I would have gone to every shul all around the country and brought it as the guest of honor for the dinner at every shul and said, look, this donkey saved the Jewish people. Amazing. Imagine what a Kiddush Hashem would come out of it. V'ro kol amei aretz ki shem Hashem nikra alecha. You know, people would actually be afraid to start up with the Jewish people if they saw that donkey. There would be such a positive toeles, such a good takeaway message that people will learn. And yet, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, we're going to forgo all of that. We're not interested. Why? Because we have to be concerned for Nebuch, the feelings of Bilam HaRasha. We have to be concerned for Bilam HaRasha. Says Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, do you not realize what that means? We're talking about Bilam HaRasha. We're talking about the evil person Bilam who tried to destroy the Jewish people, and yet we have to worry about his feelings as well. We have to be sensitive to what people are going to say about him as well. And says Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, from here we learn Kavod HaBrios is so critically important to think about how we deal with people, how we speak about people, how we interact with them, what we say, how we say it. It's so, so important, even when you're dealing with someone who might not deserve the dignity that you think that they deserve, but we have to be very, very careful. Many times in life, we are faced with dilemmas. Sometimes the decision is going to be an easy one. You're able to say good and bad. It's very clear. I quoted Natan Sharansky in the last shiur we gave. I'm going to quote him again. I don't like read Natan Sharansky all day, but I happen to have just heard this the other day. Sivan Rahav Meir was by us for Shabbos and subsequently after Shabbos for a few days. And she told me that she did an interview with Natan Sharansky and his wife Avital 3 years ago. And she was talking to them about a bunch of different things. And one of the things that Natan Sharansky said was, I'm not a hero. Go tell the youth all over the world that they are the heroes. So she said, what are you talking about? You're the one who fought for Soviet Jewry. You're the one who went into jail, who was fighting for the Jewish people. You're the one who became the hero. So what do you mean, why are they heroes? Listen what he said. He said, when I was in jail, it wasn't hard to differentiate between good and bad, between right and wrong, between evil and what was positive. It was clear. I was the good guy. All those officers who were locking me up for no good reason were all the bad ones. There was no choice that had to be made. It was clear. There was black and there was white. There's no gray. You all, the youth who are living out in the world and interacting with people and on college campuses and going out to offices and interacting with people who hate all that is good in the world, if you're enough of a strong personality to stand up for your principles and continue to live your life with those kinds of values, you're the hero. Because you're living in the confusion of life. There's no confusion where I am. The confusion is where all of us are. And life is very complicated and very confusing. So sometimes when I'm faced with a dilemma, there's right and there's wrong. And it's easy to make a choice between right and wrong. Sometimes the wrong gets the better of us, but we know what's right and wrong. There are other times where we have a dilemma, where we have a conflict, which is just completely incompatible. There's wrong, and then there's more wrong. So which wrong should I choose? Sometimes there is no good and bad. Sometimes there is no positive outcome. And the question then becomes, what should I do? And that is what we refer to as a halachic dilemma. Some people make a mistake and they think, whenever I'm faced with a halachic dilemma, the answer is sheva al tasa. Sheva al tasa means, well, if I have an option to either do A or B, A is going to mean that I'm going to actively do something wrong. B is going to mean that passively something will happen wrong, but I'm not going to do it myself. It's just going to happen with me. So then maybe I should just do B instead of doing A, because I won't actively be engaged in doing something that is negative. That's the mistaken impression that some people get. But that is not correct. It is not correct in halacha. The Gemara Maseches Erevin has the following scenario. The Gemara says there are many different karbanos, and in each of the karbanos there's a specific formula of how it's supposed to be offered in the Beis HaMikdash. You have to sprinkle the blood here, sprinkle it over there, this amount of times, that amount of times, on top of the Mizbeach, on the bottom of the Mizbeach, you're not allowed to mix it up. So says the Gemara, what happens if I have the following scenario? I have one carbon that was offered that needs to be sprinkled on the top of the Mizbeach twice, and I have a different carbon that was offered that needs to be sprinkled on the bottom of the Mizbeach once, let's say, whatever, four times. Just giving an example. And both of these bowls of blood get mixed up, and I don't know what to do. So that's called a dilemma. Why is it a dilemma? Because there's no right and wrong. Whatever I do is going to be a problem. Why is it going to be a problem? If I take both bowls of blood and I sprinkle them four times, maybe you're violating Baal Tosif, which means you're not allowed to do extra above the mitzvah that you're expected to do. If I only take both bowls and sprinkle them one time, then maybe I'm violating Baal Tigra, which is you're not allowed to minimize the amount of times that you do a mitzvah. So this is called a dilemma. Says the Gemara. The Gemara tries to figure out what should a Kohen do if he's stuck with this problem. He has two options in front of him. Both of them are bad options. Either way I go is going to be a problem. What should I do? Why isn't the honest answer very simple? Why don't you say, Sheva al Tasa? Don't do anything. The answer is the Gemara doesn't assume that Sheva al Tasa is always the answer. You have to be what Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach coins the term, Bocher b'miotara. You have to calculate what is going to bring about the least amount of negative outcome, and that's the one you go with. Sometimes it means actively doing something wrong is going to be minimizing the amount of negative outcome, and sometimes passively doing something wrong is going to minimize the negative outcome, but you have to weigh it very carefully, and it's not always so clear to make that determination. Take, for example, I'll never forget, I was in the White Shul, and they had a minhag that I've never seen anywhere else in the world. I mean, I haven't been everywhere in the world, but anywhere I've been, I've never seen it. That Shabbos afternoon, when they take the Sefer Torah out from Mincha to Lane, before they take it out of the Aron Kodesh, they remove all the gold and silver from on top of the Sefer Torah. So usually, you have a Sefer Torah, you adorn it with beautiful gold and silver, or whatever it is. There in the White Shul in Farakaway, they take the gold and silver off the Torah by Shabbos Mincha only. So I always thought it was strange. I didn't know what it was about. Somebody told me later, the reason why is because the Ramah says, the assumption is that Moshe Rabbeinu died on Shabbos afternoon. That is why the Ramah says we don't have usually a public shir and halacha between Mincha and Maariv. If you go to many shuls, they say Divrei Agada, lighter things, because Moshe Rabbeinu died. You ever notice by Mincha we say, Shabbos afternoon we say Tzidkas HaTzedek. That is a Tzidduk HaDin. It's like saying an Avarachamim for Moshe Rabbeinu. The whole Jewish world is an Avelus, because Moshe Rabbeinu died on Shabbos afternoon. Okay, so because Moshe Rabbeinu died, the White Shul has this minhag, we try to show that the Torah is missing its crown. The Torah is missing something very special, so they remove the gold and silver by Shabbos Mincha to highlight the loss of Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay, that's what they do. So it was a Yidden Shul, who used to come every Shabbos to Davin, and every Shabbos without fail I would watch him, as we took the Sefer Torah out of the Aron, he would start crying. Every Shabbos. I finally, after a couple of years of watching this, I went over to this man and I said, why do you cry every week when we take the Sefer Torah out of the Aron? I don't understand. What are you crying about? I thought, like, he's such a sensitive soul. Maybe he's crying over the loss of Moshe Rabbeinu. Like, is his name Moshe? I just couldn't understand. And he tells me the following. He says he was a Holocaust survivor. And he told me that he was a teenager at the time of the war, a preteen. He was like 11 years old, I think, 10 years old. And him and his brother were both in the town together. And the night before the Nazis came to invade the town, the Rav of his community, I forgot where it was, knocked on his door and told him and his brother, you have to stay up the whole night. I need you to do something urgently. What do you need? He says, I see that the Nazis are coming and we only have one night left before they come and ransack the whole town. Problem is, they're going to take all of our Dvarim Shebekdusha from the shul, and they're going to destroy them. So I want you to spend the night taking all the gold and silver from the Sifrei Torah in the shul and melting it into the ground. Melt it into the ground. I don't want that our gold and silver should be used for other things. The Nazis are going to use it for their purposes. I want you to take all the gold and silver and melt it into the ground. And he said, my brother and I spent the entire night melting the gold and silver from the shul into the ground. And he said, I haven't slept a single night since then. Which to me was fascinating. It wasn't the Holocaust that made him not sleep. It was what he did before the Holocaust that made him not sleep. And he said, every day I've been feeling guilty like I did the wrong thing by melting the gold and silver into the ground and destroying it. And he said, every Shabbos when we take the gold and silver off of the Sifrei Torah by Mincha, it brings me back to that moment of trauma, of me and my brother sitting there in our shtetl, melting all the gold and silver into the ground. Amazing. So I wasn't going to start getting into the particulars, if he's right, he's wrong, the halacha. I just listened to his story, I cried with him, it was amazing, amazing story. But in fact, the Shulchan Aruch says the following case. what happens if I'm traveling with a Sefer Torah? Just yesterday, someone emailed me the Shaila. They were asked to go to Eretz Yisrael to bring a Sefer Torah to a community. That's a great chaperone, you know, it's a great job. Just to travel with a Sefer Torah, you get a free trip to Eretz Yisrael, and all you need to do is drop off the Sefer Torah when you get there. It's great. So this woman wrote to me, how should I travel with the Sefer Torah? And what should I do to safeguard it? Do I have to hold it the whole time on the plane? And what happens if I put it, she said it was a very small Sefer Torah, so it would fit in a carry-on. So if my carry-on falls down in the airport the wrong way, do I have to fast? Anyway, all these kinds of questions. So the Shulchan Aruch actually talks about, how do you travel with a Sefer Torah? What should I do? And the Shulchan Aruch says, let's say I'm traveling on my horse and buggy, and I'm worried that there are going to be bandits on the road who are going to steal the merchandise, steal the luggage in the back of the truck. So I don't know what to do. How am I going to protect the Sefer Torah that I have with all the luggage? What should I do? If I hold it in my hands, the moment the bandits come, they're going to see it, and they're going to steal it and destroy it. If I put it with the suitcases, the same thing is going to happen. So what should I do? Says the Gemara, and the Shulchan Aruch quotes it. The answer is, if you're mefachei mepnei aganavim, you'd be allowed to put it under the saddle on the animal and sit on it. Now, how no one's going to notice when you're wobbling around on your seat and you can't sit straight because you have a Sefer Torah under you, I don't know. But the Shulchan Aruch writes, if you have no other option, that's what you should do. Because Bizayon Sefer Torah is something that we take very seriously, but if the reason why I'm being Mevazah the Sefer Torah is in order to protect it, that's better than the alternative. What's the alternative? The alternative is that the non-Jews are going to steal it and they're going to destroy it. So better off that I treat the Sefer Torah disrespectfully and not destroy it than to allow it to go into the hands of the Umas HaOlam and they're going to destroy it. But I'm violating an Avera Bekumva Aseh. Why don't you just say, I'll take my chances and whatever happens, happens. It's not in my hands. What, I should go and be Mevazah of the Sefer Torah? I should sit on it? The answer is yes. Maybe you should sit on it. Because that would be the best thing for the Sefer Torah's future. I'll never forget, I don't know, I don't remember which year it was, by the Hitnatkut in Gush Katif. What was that, 2014? Earlier? No?
Yeah.
You were alive, I assume?
It was the year of our Bat Mitzvah.
Okay.
It was 2014.
Yeah, that's when it was. I think it was 2014. So, it happened in the summertime, and my family, my parents, and I, and my siblings happened to be in Eretz Yisrael that summer. And there was a lot of back and forth political issues going on, and fighting and rallies every night. There was a lot going on. It was a terrible time for the Jewish people, a big black stain on the Israeli government for doing such a terrible thing. But leaving politics aside, there were a lot of people who were in total disbelief that this was actually going to happen. And when they were told, you know, it's going to happen in a week, they're going to throw you out of their house, they hadn't packed the thing, they hadn't made any arrangements, any plans, they just didn't believe that this was going to happen. So I remember 2 days before the disengagement, they invited my father to come give shiurim in the yeshivas there in Gush Katif. And it was like a regular day. It was like there was nothing going on. All the svarim were on the shelves, all the boys were there. It was like literally like nothing was coming. So we went around and we were visiting all the different yeshivas. And at the time, we actually had to be given a special pass from the Israeli government to go in because at that point, they weren't letting anyone come into Gush Katif. Because they realized anyone who comes in is going to pitch a tent and stay there, going to make it harder for the police to get rid of everyone. So like 2 weeks before the disengagement, they stopped allowing anyone to come into Gush Katif because they said, if you're not a resident, all you're going to do is make trouble here, make it more difficult. So that's what happened. So we went. And in one of the yeshivas, I remember we came out, and the Rosh Yeshiva turned to my father and asked him the following shaila as we left. And he said, I built this community from the ground up. I did everything to make this community what it is. And I built this yeshiva, and now I have a kollel, and a lot of the young married families move back into the community. And it's amazing. And he said, I know what's going to happen. I know that what's going to happen is that the Umas HaOlam, the Arabs, are going to take this over. And what's going to happen when they take it over? They're going to use it as a mosque, or they're going to use it as something for their own purposes. So he said, I'd like to know, am I allowed to firebomb the building of the Beis Medrash before I leave? My Beis Medrash, my shul that I built with my own two hands, my community. When I see that this is actually happening, am I allowed to bomb the building on my way out so that at least our enemies won't have a building? Or would you say that's Bizayon Beis HaKnesses? And how can you do that? The Torah says, "Lo sasun kein Hashem Elokeichem." You're not allowed to destroy the property of Hekdish. You're not allowed to destroy something holy. So how would I be allowed to destroy Beis HaKnesses? On the other hand, if the reason why I'm doing it is that there shouldn't be something worse that comes out of it, maybe it would be allowed. So this is a halachic dilemma. Not where good and bad is so clear, but where bad and bad are both options. And the question is, how should I be bocher b'miyotara? There's a very interesting shuva that Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has commenting on the Ramah. The Ramah says in Shulchan Aruch HaRachayim that if I have a situation where I have somebody who's not going to make a bracha on the food, I'm not allowed to offer them food, a Jew. Obviously, a non-Jew is not mechuyev to make a bracha. But if I have a Jew who I know is not going to recite a bracha, I'm not allowed to give him food. So the question was, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach had the following scenario. There was a family from England who dedicated a building to his yeshiva. Yeshiva Kol Torah in Bayit Vegan. And the problem was, the dedication ceremony was in the middle of the summer, and Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach realized they were boiling hot. So he invited them up to his office to come have a drink, to come have something to eat. And all the Talmidim afterward were shocked. What do you mean? The Ramah says you're not allowed to invite someone who you know is not going to make a bracha. How can you offer them food? So Rav Shlomo Zalman wrote a response to defend why he did what he did. And he starts off and he says, I can't believe that I even have to write such a thing. It's so obvious what the answer is. And he says, the fact that my Talmidim didn't understand it is a pagam in my Talmidim. There's something wrong with them. So what's the explanation? Says Rav Shlomo Zalman as follows. Imagine you have a patient who's very, very sick. And they have an infection. And the doctor says, listen, the only way to deal with the infection is we're going to have to amputate your leg. If you don't amputate the leg, the infection is going to spread and you're going to die from it. So they do the amputation and the person then gets a prosthetic and they live happily ever after. When you look at that doctor, would you say he's a mazik or he's a merape? When you look in the abstract, would you say that that doctor is somebody who destroys people's lives? Or would you say, no, that doctor just saved a life? How would you look at it? Which one is it? The answer, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, is as uncomfortable as it is to have to amputate someone's limb, that was the only option to keep them alive. And the only reason why you're still alive today is only because of what the doctor did. So I wouldn't look at the doctor negatively. I would say the doctor has done the wonderful thing of saving someone's life. And therefore, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, that is why this is permissible to do this as well. Because here I had a family who dedicated a building to a yeshiva. It was their first interaction with Orthodox Jews. It's a burning hot sunny day in the summer in Israel. And I'm not going to offer them a drink. What are they going to walk away saying? Oh, these religious Jews are so disrespectful. They have no sensitivity. Nobody bothered to offer us a drink. 100 degrees outside in Yerushalayim. They're going to walk away violating the Aveira of Los Sisnas Achicha Bilavavecha. They're going to hate a Jew. Because they're not going to understand why I wouldn't offer them a drink. It's better off that I do something like this, which is offer them a drink without making a bracha, as opposed to allowing them to violate an issur d'oraisa of hating another Jew. So these are halachic dilemmas. These are problems, scenarios that we face sometimes, where the outcome has to be measured very carefully. You have to evaluate what are the options in front of you. And sometimes it's not obvious at all what the right option is to do. What am I supposed to do? So here we come to the following scenario, which is a halachic dilemma that the Gemara describes. Amrav Yehuda Amarav, Hamotzi Kilayim Bebigdo. If somebody discovers, as they're walking in the middle of the street, they realize that they have an article of clothing that is made, manufactured from Kilayim, it has woolen linen, says the Gemara in Brachos, Poshto Afila Beshuk. You have to take your clothing off, even in the middle of the street. What do you mean, get undressed in the middle of the street? I'm embarrassed. I don't want to do that. Says the Gemara, my taima, ein chachma vein tvuna vein etzel leneged Hashem. Kal makom sheyesh chilul Hashem, ein chokin kavel rav. You could be the most distinguished sanua person in the world. But if this is not what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to do, then you don't do it. And therefore, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want you to be wearing this, even if you're the most prominent, most important person in town, and you're going to be extremely humiliated in the middle of the street walking around like this, you have to do it anyway. You have to do it anyway because b'makom sheyesh chilul Hashem ein cholkin kavod harav. If there's a chilul Hashem by you violating the Aveira and the Torah by wearing the shatnez, we don't care who you are. It doesn't make a difference. You have to overlook yourself, and you have to focus on what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants. It's similar to a Gemara Maseches Kiddushin, where the Gemara says that there are certain activities that we assume your position doesn't allow you to be involved in such activities. So says the Gemara, Parnes, if you have a governor, Kivin Shenesman Alat Sivur, Aser Lo Sheyaseh Melacha B'fnei Shlosha. Let's say you have a governor who's very handy. You have a president of a country, prime minister, very handy person. So one day his car breaks down. So he's going to go underneath the car and start playing with the screws and getting his hands all dirty and doing an oil change. That's not respectful for the kind of position that that person holds. And therefore the Gemara says, if you hold a position of dignity, a position of power, a position where people are looking to you with a certain sense of respect, you have to hold on to that self-respect and you have to uphold the dignity that your position is deserving of. However, says the Gemara, Aval Yachal Hu Livnos Maket. If you're the governor of the town, you shouldn't do your oil change, and you shouldn't get onto the car to change the tire. You should have someone else do it. But if you have to build a maka on your roof, or you have to go build a sukkah, or anything like that, says the Gemara, well, what's that? What are you, embarrassed? You think it's beneath you? This is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to do. Who cares? Well, what are you taking into account? Your title, your position, doesn't make a difference. What matters right now is, what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want me to do? What he wants me to do is to build a sukkah, is to build a market, is to do what I'm supposed to do, and therefore I leave everything else aside. The Chavos Yair is quoted in the Mishneh Berurah. Chavos Yair, Rabbi Yair Bachrach, in the 1700s, has the following shaila. There was a rabbi who had a very good voice, and somebody asked him to come play music or sing at a chasana, to be Mesameach HaSemekala. Now the rabbi's job usually at the chasana is not to be the singer. The rabbi was supposed to be the Mesada Kedushin. But aside from that, they were asking him to also use his talent of his good voice to sing for the Chasan and Kala, and he felt, it's beneath me. I would never do such a thing. I would never get up in public and put on a concert. That's not what I'm supposed to be doing. That's for the singers. So the question became, is that a violation of his position to then go ahead and use his voice to be Mesameach Chasan and Kala, or perhaps not? And the answer that the Chavos Yair gave is, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us there's a mitzvah to be Mesameach Chasan and Kala, then why are you embarrassed? It's not beneath you to use your voice for a mitzvah. That's what you're supposed to be doing. So over here as well, says the Gemara, you think that your human dignity is so important? Of course human dignity is very important, and Kavod Abrios is something we need to think about all the time for ourselves and for others as well. But at the same time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is even more important than that. And we have to be willing to overlook our own self-respect in order to uphold the dignity of HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. Yeah? Correct, but the Gemara says greater disrespect is to violate the laws of the Torah. That's correct. So then the Gemara gets into a little bit of a difficult discussion here. The bottom line of the Gemara is as follows. If what I'm faced with, if what I'm confronted with is only an Issur D'Rabbanan, then I would say Kavod HaBrios is certainly more important than an Issur D'Rabbanan. Of course, Issur D'Rabbanan we take very seriously. We don't violate Muktzah on Shabbos just because it's the Rabbanan. But still, in context, if you have an Issur D'Rabbanan on the one hand, and you have Kavod HaBrios on the other hand, we would say Kavod HaBrios comes before an Issur D'Rabbanan. If you have an Issur D'Oraisa, then perhaps the Gemara says, that's when the Gemara says that I have to overlook my own human dignity, and I have to be willing to give Kavod to HaKadosh Baruch Hu by even getting undressed in the middle of the street. Okay, what's an example of that principle? The Yerushalmi writes the following case. Let's say somebody is getting a haircut, and you're in the middle of your haircut, and somebody walks in, Rahman al-Litzlan, somebody walks into the barbershop while you're literally in the middle, getting your makeup done, getting your hair done, and in the middle of the whole thing, somebody walks in and says, I'm sorry to inform you, your father just passed away. You're an Avelis. Now, an Avel is not supposed to get a haircut. But I'm in the middle. So what do? I'm going to stop now. I'm going to look ridiculous. So what do? Says the Yerushalmi, in a case like that, you finish up the haircut. And then you go home. Why do you finish up the haircut? Because Avelus is only a Din D'Rabbanan that you're not allowed to take a haircut. The Torah never says you're not allowed to take haircuts during Avelus. So when I have a violation of Kavod HaBrios versus taking a haircut, that we would say Kavod HaBrios comes before the Din D'Rabbanan of taking a haircut. Take for a more practical example, I assume that doesn't happen too often. I actually did have a situation where somebody, Rabbi Orlean from Lawrence, you know, Orlean from Stern College? Nobody knows her?
Yeah.
Somebody?
Yeah.
She does work here, right?
Yeah.
So I get emails from her, so I guess she's here. So her husband passed away, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. I don't remember exactly when. And her son is a Rav in a shul in Lawrence. And he was in the middle of davening Shemona Esrei. And somebody informed him in the middle of davening, somebody walked in and told him that his father died. What happened? Well, who would do that in the middle of davening? The answer was, he was davening in the hospital next to his father's hospital bed. And in the middle, the doctors walked in and said, oh, you know, he died. Now, an onein, the halacha is an onein is not allowed to daven, not allowed to say brachas, not allowed to do other things. So he then had the question, what am I supposed to do? I'm halfway through Shemona Esrei. So do I stop in the middle? Then it means everything that I said until now is a bracha levatela. If I keep going, then everything I'm going to do going forward is going to be a bracha levatela because I'm not supposed to daven. That was his question. A shir for another time. So he called me from the hospital to ask me what to do. It was a very interesting shayla. I gave a shir about it. I thought it was very, very interesting to discuss that. But over here, so I was reminded of that case, of the haircut. I'm finishing up the haircut, but maybe that's different. Covered up Rios. Anyway, interesting discussion. But I assume this is not so practical. What's a very practical case? So the practical case is, the Shulchan Aruch writes the following. When somebody used to relieve themselves in the days of the Shulchan Aruch, how did they clean their body? They didn't have tissues. They used to use rocks. I can't even wrap my head around how rocks are able to clean people off. I don't get it. Like, imagine changing a baby's diaper with a rock. I don't know, it's hard for me to understand. But that's what they used to do. So the Shulchan Aruch says, what do you do on Shabbos? On Shabbos, rocks are muksa. So what do I do on Shabbos if I don't have a rock to clean myself? So I'm just going to go out into the field and take any rock? Isn't that a violation of muksa? Says Shulchan Aruch, yes, it is a violation of muksa, but the problem is, if I don't use a rock, that's going to be a great violation of kavod abrios. Would I have to be dirty the rest of Shabbos because I couldn't pick up a rock because of muksa? And therefore the Shulchan Aruch says, of course, you should violate the Yisud Rabbanon of muksa in order not to violate the principle of kavod abrios. Also not irrelevant for our discussion because we don't use rocks today. So what would be relevant? Toilet paper. What if I don't have tissues in the bathroom? And here I am in a situation where I like to clean my body, but I don't have anything to use. So the Shmir Shabbos Kechasa says, would I be allowed to rip toilet paper not on the perforations? Ripping it on the perforations, it's potentially an Issa D'Oraisa. If I rip it off the perforations, would that be something that I'd be allowed to do? It's an Issa D'Rabbanan. But maybe I'd be allowed to do it in order not to violate kavod abrios. That is the psak of the Shmir Shabbos Gechasa, that if you're stuck in a situation like that, you'd be allowed to do so in order not to violate the iser of kavod abrios. In order not to violate human dignity, we would be allowed to overlook an iser derabbanan. So listen to the following shayla. I remember a couple of years ago, it was more than a couple of years ago, somebody walked into the Beis Medrash. I was learning with my father. It was a Sunday morning. And he came to ask my father the following shayla. I was so amazed by it. Right after he finished talking to my father about it, I called Rav Asher Weiss, and I told him, we got to hear this question. It was so amazing. And he wrote a tshuva about it. My father spoke about it also. Very interesting. So here's the story. There was a couple that got married on a Thursday night. Okay, wonderful. They got married. The problem was, what's the one job that the chassan has before he comes to the wedding?
Get a ring.
Get a ring. And then after he gets the ring? Bring it to the wedding. Right? It's his one job. He doesn't have to get a gown. And he's not worried about his shaitels and his things and his apartment. All he needs to do is get a ring. Buy it with your own money and bring it to the wedding. And you know how many weddings there have been where the ring didn't show up? The one job, the shlamazel, doesn't show up with the ring. So this guy knew that he's not so organized and he doesn't always do what he's supposed to do. He went and he bought the ring and he said, you know what, I'm not taking chances. I'm nervous. I'm going to forget it. I have so many other things to think about, to worry about. He gave it to his older sister who was married, and he said, it's your job to make sure that when I walk down the aisle, after I'm under the chuppah, you walk next to me, slip the ring into my pocket, and I'll be good. Fine, that's what they made up, that's what they did. It all worked. Comes under the chuppah, his sister walks down, slips the ring into his pocket, harei mekudeshesli, everything's fine, they got married, shalom al Yisrael. Comes Friday night, Shavuot Brachos, you know the story? It's amazing. Comes Friday night Shavuot Brachos. It became famous after they wrote about it. Comes Friday night Shavuot Brachos, and the minhag is, the Rama says that when you wash your hands for the Netilas Yadayim, you're supposed to remove your rings. Why? Because it's considered to be a chatzitza. All right, so we take off rings. So Friday night, his sister goes to wash her hands. By the wedding, she didn't wash. There's too much going on, the pictures, the kids running around. She didn't wash. Comes Friday night, was the first time she washed her hands. Now, why she didn't wash her hands in the morning, Tila Sedayim, Friday morning, I don't know, she was up the whole night. So, comes Friday night, washes her hands, and she takes off her rings, and she says, oh, that's a problem. She didn't want to forget to bring the ring to the wedding, so she put it on her finger. When she slipped the ring to her brother under the chuppah, she mistakenly gave him her ring, and she was wearing his ring. So it turns out, here we are Friday night, there's 100 guests who are there for the Sheva Brachos. Chasan and Kala aren't even married, because he used a ring that didn't belong to him. She had no kavana at all to be makna to him. She thought it was his. She didn't think it was hers. So it's true. When you have an emergency under the chuppah and the ring gets lost, which happens every once in a while. Ever told you that? It happened with me? Last semester I told you. Told you this semester also? Okay, good. Made such an impact on me. I like to share it. So every so often you have a situation where you don't have a ring for whatever reason. So you go to someone, you buy it off of them, you figure it out, make a kinyan. It's okay. Transfer ownership. Here, she had no intention at all to transfer. She thought she was giving him his ring. In the end, she gave him her own ring. So she only realized Friday night. So what do? You're about to have a Sheva Brachos. Now you have to get up and make an announcement. By the way, I'm sorry to inform all of you, we're not going to have Sheva Brachos tonight. We can all enjoy ourselves, but the Chassan and Kala have to go sleep in two different homes, and we're not allowed to make Sheva Brachos, and after Shabbos, we'll all reconvene to make a wedding again. Do we need to do that? So you'll say, why don't we just get married on Shabbos? Have you ever heard of a wedding on Shabbos? No, why not? Says the Gemara Maseches Beitza, you're not allowed to get married on Shabbos. Why are you not allowed to get married on Shabbos?
Okay,
yeah. You see, I knew it. The article writes that the girls in Stern don't learn enough Gemara. Knew? It's clear. Why are you not allowed to... Why are you not allowed to... I'm sorry, that was a joke. Why are you not allowed to... all the Gemara you have to know, you'll learn right here. Why is it that you're not allowed to get married on Shabbos? What's the answer? Because there's an Issur D'Rabbanan of Mekach U'Memkar. You're not allowed to do a transaction on Shabbos. And over here, it looks like a transaction. It's not actually a transaction. I'm not buying, the wife is not buying her husband, a husband, not, but it looks like it. There's an exchange. He says, Arayat, he gives her a ring. Oh, they get married. The status changes. So it looks like a business deal. And therefore, the assumption is, no getting married on Shabbos. Issur D'Rabbanan of Mekach U'Memkar. So what do we do? What do we do? So, I feel very bad for the Rav of the community because he's probably a very fine, wonderful Talmud Chacham. But when does one ever get a Shiloh like this? So how's he supposed to know the answer? They ran down the street to his house. They asked him what to do. He says, look, you're not allowed to get married on Shabbos. You have to call off the Sheva Brachos, tell everybody that it's over, and Matzah Shabbos will make a wedding, and Chasan and Kala have to sleep in two different apartments, and whatever. It is what it is. So it was very uncomfortable. That's what they did. And again, I don't blame him. How's he supposed to know? So Sunday morning, one of the relatives comes to YU, and he tells my father, you're not going to believe it. I was at the Sheva Brachos this week, and this is what happened, and it was amazing. Listen to the story. Tells my father. So he says, what would you have said if we knocked on your door? My father said right away, literally right away. And what I was amazed by was when I called Rav Asher Weiss, he said the same thing right away. Just the thought process is amazing. A real posig knows how to take from the abstract and apply it to a situation. So he said the following. The Rama writes, it's not the Rama in Shulchan Aruch, it's the Rama in a tshuva. So first of all, who knows all the Ramas in Shulchan Aruch off the cuff in the first place? Even if you do, because you're so learned, who ever read the Tshuva Sarama that is not even quoted in the Shulchan Aruch itself? Nobody. Okay, but great people know those things. So the Rama says the following in his Tshuva. He has the following story. Where did the Rama live? Krakow. When did he live? 1800s? No, 1500s. The Rama lived in the 1500s, same time as the Shulchan Aruch. The Beis Yosef lived in Svat. The Rama lived in Krakow in Poland. They were not in touch with each other about writing the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama at the same time. Just so happened, that's what happened. That they both wrote the same kind of Pirush to guide people how to live life on a day-to-day basis. It was a groundbreaking sefer, the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama. So the Rama had the following scenario. There was a girl in his community who got engaged. And the minhag back then was that when a girl got engaged, she had to put up a nedunya, she had to put up a dowry in order to ensure that the couple would be able to stay married and be able to monetarily sustain themselves. That was the understanding. We don't do this today, but that's what they did back then. Problem was, there was a girl in Krakow who didn't have a father. So what's going to happen? She doesn't have a father to give money for her to get married. which boy is ever going to marry her? So that's not fair. Nobody's going to marry her. She's wonderful. She has Yira Shamayim. She's beautiful. We're going to say she shouldn't get married just because she doesn't have a father to give her money. So she gets engaged. And the Gabayim of the community said, we're going to promise to have the money by the wedding date. We're going to put up whatever it is that's necessary, that's the standard for any girl in our community. We're going to make sure to raise it on our own. Okay, the wedding was scheduled for Friday afternoon. Why Friday afternoon? In Europe, many people used to get married on Friday afternoon. Today, it's not so common. We don't do it. Why did they do it then? They did it because there's a chiyuv, there's an obligation to have a sudas mitzvah, to have a meal. Which reminds me, my father told me a story this Shabbos, such an amazing story that has nothing to do with our shir, but I have no other place to share it. It just has something to do with the sudas mitzvah. It's a gevaldic story. So on Shabbos, somehow we got into a discussion. Remind me where we're up to after I'm done. But this is great. So we were talking on Shabbos at the table, something about my parents were by us. We were talking about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It came up, and everyone started telling stories about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Not sure why. Oh, that's why. Because Sivan Rahab Meir was by us, and she was telling how she loves going to the Ohel, and she loves davening there, and she loves the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and she's very inspired by him. So everyone by the table started telling stories. So my father said that even if 90% of the stories that they say about the Lubavitcher Rebbe are an exaggeration and aren't true and are made up, even if only 10% of them are true, it's still amazing. The amazing ability of this man, of this individual, to do what he did and all the mofsim and amazing things they say, it's overwhelming. So my father was saying what a great person the Lubavitcher Rebbe was, and he tells us the following story. He said that there was once a couple that flew in from out of the United States, and they wanted to go see the Lubavitcher Rebbe, they wanted a bracha, and they came for other things, and while they were here, they decided to go for a bracha to Lubavitcher Rebbe. Okay, so they went, and he gave them a bracha, they should be matzliach, they should have nachas from their children, whatever it was, and what happened was, as they were leaving, as they were walking out of the Lubavitcher Rebbe's office, he turned to them, he said, no, come back, I want to give you a bottle of wine for the chasana. So this guy felt very uncomfortable, like, you know, all of his children were married. He didn't mention anything about anyone getting married. But he didn't want to embarrass the Lubavitcher Rebbe, so he said, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And then he walked out. He took the bottle of wine. So he goes home, and him and his wife are talking, like, what are we going to do with this bottle of wine? Like, we felt uncomfortable, but in the end of the day, he gave it to us for a chasana. Like, should we give it to someone else? Should we save it for the grandchildren? Like, our grandchildren are little. What are we going to, we're going to wait 20 years to use it for a wedding? Strange. So he wasn't sure what to make of the whole thing. Fine. 2 years go by, and they keep this bottle of wine somewhere in the cabinet. And he said, again, you can tune out. This has nothing to do with anything. It's a great story. So he says that it was their a major milestone, 30th anniversary, maybe more, 40th anniversary, and they decided they were going to have a big get-together, and they were going to celebrate with the whole family. So the husband said, you know, this would be a great opportunity to take the bottle of wine along, and, you know, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the chasana, we're celebrating an anniversary, I don't know, whatever. So he decided maybe that's what the Lubavitcher Rebbe meant, that when we have a big celebration with the family celebrating our chasana, maybe that's what we should do. So he took the bottle of wine, and they decided they were going to go to a restaurant. He didn't want his wife to have to prepare a whole thing. They were going to go to a restaurant, even though the family never went out. They go to a restaurant, the restaurant is full. They go to another one, it's full. They go a few blocks away. Finally, they find a place, and they all sit down together. And a couple of minutes after they're gathered together, somebody walks in, a Rav walks in, and he says, by the way, there's a catering hall down the block. And I want you to know, I'm doing a chasana, I'm doing a chuppah now for a zivuk sheni. There's a couple that's getting married for the second time. Both of them were married previously. And the minig is that children sometimes go to the wedding, don't go to the wedding. So neither of their kids came. They didn't want to make a whole to-do out of this wedding. They didn't want to pay money. They didn't want to, So they didn't even bring a minion. They asked me to be a Masada Kedushin, but there's no one here. But you need to have a minion in order to make Shever Brachos under the chuppah. So can I borrow a couple of you guys who are here to come down the block? And this story gets much crazier. To come down the block and join us for the minion. They're like, oh, so great, of course, no problem, we're going to go. So the whole family picks up, goes down the block to this wedding, tells the restaurant to hold their seats, we'll be back soon, we're going to be Mesameach HaSamekala, and they all go, and there they are, sitting there, listening to the Shev Brachos. After it was over, they're like, oh, that's it? Like, no plan to do anything else. Walks over to the Chassan. The Chassan was like 70 years old, and he says to him, you know, by the way, there's a halacha that when you get married, you have to have a sudas mitzvah. So he said, yeah, but that's like when you get married when you're 20, not when you get married when you're 70 or 80. Like, this is not what we do. He said, no. When you get married, you have to have a sudas mitzvah. You know what? We're having a 30th wedding anniversary celebration right down the block in the restaurant. Why don't you and your wife come and we'll make shever brachas there? That will be the wedding suda. That will be the sudas mitzvah. We'll all join together with you. We were here at the chuppah. Why don't you come join us there? He says, fine. Turns to his new wife. He says, would you like to join them? Sure. They all come down the block. And he turns to the chassan and kali. He says, you're not going to believe it. A few years ago, I was by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he gave me a bottle of wine, and he said, this is for the chasana, and we saved it for the special occasion. And as he's telling the story, the kala, who's 65 years old, bursts out crying, and like is beside herself, can't get over it, doesn't know what to say. And finally they ask her, like, what's going on? So she said, my husband died a number of years ago, and I've been dating, and I was always worried, is this person going to be better than my first husband? Is he going to disappoint me? And every person that I dated, I was measuring up to my previous husband, and I was worried whether it's appropriate for my children. Should I marry him? Should I not? And I want compassion from another person in my life, but maybe my kids aren't going to be happy. I had all these things. And I asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu, give me a siman min hashamayim that this should be the right one. So I went for a bracha to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe told me, don't worry, you'll find the right shidduch, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to give you a siman that is the right one. How do you like that? That's an amazing story. Anyway, back to the scheduled program here. So the Rama writes, they used to have weddings on Friday afternoon. Why they have it on Friday afternoon? Because people were so poor, they didn't have any money. So they wanted to save money on the wedding meal. They used to have the Friday night meal count for the wedding meal as well. Okay, so that's what they used to do. Problem was, everyone gathers together in the shul to have this chuppah Friday afternoon. Chassan shows up and he says, all right, where's the money? You told me you were going to have X amount of money that was collected. Where is it? And the gabbaim are hemming and hawing. We got most of it. We didn't get everything. He says, listen, I love you very much, but, you know, we're not doing this. If we don't have any money to live, then we're not getting married. And he calls off the shidduch. And it was a devastating thing. You have a yesoma in town, waiting to get married. Everybody tried to help out. And now the guy calls off the shidduch and walks out. It's terrible. So everybody goes into Kabbalah Shabbos. And they daven Maariv. And in the middle of Maariv, the gabbait stucker from town walks into shul, huffing and puffing, and he says, I finally collected the last amount of money that we need. I have everything that's necessary for this girl to get married. So the Rama stood up on the bima, and he said, we're going to have the wedding right now. He's going to be Masada Kedushin on Friday night, even though you're not allowed to get married on Shabbos. This Gzer Mishamekach Memkar said, the Rama, do you understand the Kavod Abrios here? Do you understand how humiliating this is for this woman? In the first place, the whole community had to come together and raise money for her. Like, that wasn't embarrassing enough. Then she comes to shul to get married. The chassan walks out on her. And now we're going to say she's going to have to wait till Matzah Shabbos to get married? I'm going to do the wedding right now. You're not allowed to make a wedding on Friday night. You can't make a wedding on Shabbos. The answer is, yeah, that's an Issa D'Rabbanan on Mekach U'Memkar. But Kavod Abrios is more important than an Issa D'Rabbanan. And said the Rama, that's what we're going to do. So my father said, if I was there, I would have said, pull the chassan and kala aside, bring them into another room with two eidim, with two witnesses, and do the wedding Friday night. What are you going to do? You're going to go in and explain to everyone and embarrass everybody? It doesn't make sense to do that. So what I found amazing about it was, Rav Asher Weiss right away instinctively said the same thing, that we can draw a parallel, a comparison from that tshuva of the Rama to this situation. But the bottom line is that there are so many situations where we have a conflict. I see we don't have time to get into all them, but we have many, many different cases in halacha. I was going to discuss many other ones where we have a conflict between kavod abrios and adin derabanan or adin deraisa, and that is what the Gemara discusses. But it all comes from the case of shatnez. Let me leave you with one last case. I'm not going to get into it, what the answer is, but just to think about the case. I remember I was once in Rav Asher Weiss's office in Yerushalayim, and it amazed me that this couple came in. It says so much about the couple, first of all. And it says even more about their relationship with the Rav, that they have the ability to present a question that is so embarrassing, And they're not afraid that the person is going to judge them for even presenting the question. I think it's something to aspire toward, that you should choose somebody in your life that you can turn to and not be ashamed to ask questions because you know they're not going to judge you. So they asked the following question. They wanted to know, they both came from frum families. But they said, our families have no idea what we're up to. Both of us are not as much Shomrei Torah mitzvahs as we should be. And we've been living together for years in the same apartment and doing all kinds of things that we shouldn't be doing. We got engaged. Our families are all excited. And they prepared a wedding for us and a Sheva Brachas for us and everything. It's going to be in 6 months from now. But the truth is, we're living together. Our families don't know. Well, we've been living together forever. So they wanted to know, would it be better to save ourselves from violating Yisurim over the next 6 months by living together? Would it be better if we got married today, didn't tell anybody, just got married with a quiet few people, and then at least over the next 6 months, we won't be violating Yisurim every time we're living in the same house and living, being intimate with each other? Is that better? Or is it better that we continue to live Be'isur over the next 6 months, and then go ahead with the wedding in 6 months from now, and okay, whatever we do over the next 6 months is what we do. What's the problem with getting married now? Problem with getting married now is we're not going to tell anybody. So in 6 months from now, when we get married, you're going to have people coming under the chuppah making shever brachas. You're going to have every night of the week, someone else is going to make bracha levatala after bracha levatala every single night, 7 nights in a row. So would we be allowed to do that if we know that by getting married now, we're going to save ourselves from an isser, but it's going to cause something terrible on the other end? I was amazed by the shaila. Absolutely amazed. First of all, the creativity of such a shaila is amazing. How they came up with such an idea is great. But the fact that they were comfortable enough to ask such a question speaks volumes about the relationship they have with the Rav and the relationship they feel comfortable with presenting a question and not being judged. To me, that was really amazing. Again, a little bit of a complex, complicated answer, but something that also touches on this whole discussion that the Gemara has with regard to Shatnas and Kilayim, whether or not there are times when we're faced with a dilemma and perhaps we'd be allowed to do something not because it's the right thing to do, but rather because when we're faced with these two negative options, maybe this is the better option of the two, even though it's also a bad option. But that's what a dilemma means. A dilemma means it's not black and white. A dilemma means it's gray. And a dilemma means we're not exactly sure where to turn, and that's where we have to make the delicate decision of what is the right thing to do. Anyway,